Last spring, I was invited to the blessing of a newly built fishing house in the Columbia River Gorge. It was the week of the first salmon feast, when the native people who live by the river celebrate the return of the spring salmon. They pray and feast in the longhouse, across a freeway and railroad tracks from what's left of the ancient fishing grounds at Salado Falls. There, the Columbia River once tumbled into a magnificent waterfall, where salmon leap their way upstream in the spring and summer and fall. Now the falls is inundated by the backwaters of the Dalles Dam, which silenced the roaring river in 1957. At the blessing ceremony, tribal elders and Army Corps of Engineer officers took turns speaking. The clamor of a freight train interrupted the speech of an Army Corps Brigadier General. He stood silent for the several minutes it took the train to pass, then apologized.
Well, just another sign of the white man's noise that he's brought to the valley here. I'm sorry.
Years ago, I spent the night on top of a cliff across the river from Celilo, where a famous pictograph, She Who Watches, gazes out across the gorge. This picture of an animal woman was painted on the rocks long before anyone remembers, and no one is quite sure what she's supposed to represent. But it is known that she is there to watch. She watches the changes that have been wrought on this landscape by the coming of white people, who built the railroads that thunder just below her, the freeway that slices through land formations across the river, and the dams that drowned the rapids and falls where salmon once thrived. That night I sat and tried to see what she sees, and to imagine what this landscape was like before its transformation. Since that night, I've learned many things about what lies beneath the glassy surface of the tamed Columbia River upon which she gazes. You're listening to Radio Tales for the Road, and in this show, Hidden Waters, we'll hear two stories about what happens when we try to take the wildness out of nature. Part 1, Underwater Waterfalls. It was early winter when I sneaked onto the top of the Bonneville Dam and looked out at the Columbia River. After driving past this dam for nearly 30 years without ever stopping, I finally had a reason to check out this eyesore in the midst of all the scenic wonders in the Columbia River Gorge. I had just learned that beneath the placid water backed up against the dam, there was a long stretch of rapids that the Indians called the Cascades. Before the dams turned this raging river into a series of slack water reservoirs, millions of salmon leaped these rapids every spring and fall. That winter, I was driving through the gorge almost every week and got to know every dip and rise of the highway. The Columbia Gorge is the only sea-level passageway through the mountains that range from Canada to Southern California, and much of the road between Portland and Hood River is flat. But as I traveled that road that winter, I became aware of a series of hills that begins just before the Bonneville Dam and continues for several miles past the dam cement walls and powerhouses and the red and white transmission line towers. I wondered if these hills mirrored the drowned rapids that I was driving along. The steep gorge walls rise up abruptly on either side of the river. Dark gray pinnacles and spires of basalt jut out above the deep green and brown of Douglas fir and cedar rainforests. Where the rocks fold upon themselves, waterfalls rush toward the river in a lacy spray of water and foam. Signs along the freeway announce exits for the waterfall area, but there are no signs to remind us of the even more magnificent water show that is now drowned behind the Bonneville Dam. I parked my car by the visitor's center and started walking toward the dam. A heavy metal gate was thrown open, so I followed the service road that took me on top of the dam. Below me, out of sight, was the roar of the spillway. By my feet, I spied a deep square cement-lined pit that must descend to the bottom of the riverbed. I was amazed by its depth and emptiness. I was standing in the middle of what should be a river, but instead, there was a hole. I turned and gazed at the wide expanse of backwater that drowned the rugged rocky shores of this once wild stretch of water and extended flat and placid all the way to Hood River, 30 miles to the east. I wondered, do the rapids still run beneath this calm facade? I imagined they must. Instead of the motor noise of the turbines, I could hear the roaring of the rapids. Before my eyes, I saw a salmon ballet. As fish leaped high in the air, their silvery bodies pirouetting over white water. Later, I visited the fish ladders. I stood in a basement room surrounded by a bank of windows where you're supposed to see salmon swimming by. Instead of a show of live salmon, a TV monitor was set up in one of the windows. A sign above the monitor explained that the salmon were not running at this time of year, but the video was here to show what they look like when they do climb the fish ladders during the runs. I watched a bewildered salmon on the videotape trying to find its way through this man-made maze back to its spawning grounds. I couldn't help feeling that I was watching a scene in the future when the only salmon that return up the Columbia River will be on this videotape. I remembered seeing a fragment of an old newsreel from the 1930s that celebrated the opening of the Bonneville Dam. It showed Native American fishermen catching the last run of salmon before the dam's floodgates closed. On the soundtrack, I heard a voice declare,
"Vanishing salmon for the vanishing red men."
I returned to my car and headed back toward the freeway. I passed the heavy metal gate that had allowed me through to the top of the dam. It was closed now, and I noticed what I hadn't seen before. Stark white letters and a large blue sign warning me, "No unauthorized personnel beyond this point."
Asleep in the air, nothing to see, nothing to hear. I watch before me unwind the course of a frozen river of time, carving canyons in the sand, reshaping the land in the palm of your hand. I sit where the river flows. Spirits whisper when the wind starts to blow. Future and past all entwined. A river in motion yet frozen in time. Carving canyons in the sand. Reshaping the land in the palm of your hand. Where the river flows, I sit where the river flows, where the river flows.
Part 2, Occult Waters. A river runs through the city where I live, and it's only a few minutes' walk from my house to its shore. Sometimes I take this river for granted. I've lived here so long. But other times, when I sit by the river, I remember how Lewis and Clark were captivated by extraordinary tales they heard from native people about this magnificent river that drained the entire length of the Cascade Mountains, and how they went out of their way to discover its confluence with the Columbia. In the time that I've lived so close to the river, I've learned to tell the seasons from its changing colors and current. I've watched it flood and recede and recontour the landscape along its banks. And although I know that the river level is controlled by a series of dams upstream, I like to think that there's still some natural connection between the changing river levels and the snowmelt from Mount Hood. I always wanted to live in a river town. I grew up in a small city in central New England, and when I was young, I was astounded to learn that there was a river that ran through my town, the Blackstone River, but it was underground. I didn't understand how a river could run underground. Later, I was told that the Blackstone River had once flowed above ground like a real river, but long before I was born, it was imprisoned underground in a sewer pipe. I couldn't figure out why anyone would do that to a river. Four years ago, there was a 100-year flood in Portland, Oregon, and many of my friends discovered small rivers rising in their basements. That was when many of us learned that hundreds of miles of creeks were constrained in cement pipes, culverted under the streets and houses of our city, where they flow silently and invisibly, until extraordinary forces of nature remind us of their presence. While my friends pumped out their basements day and night and watched their backyard gardens drown, I observed all these little creeks reemerging into daylight, like veins popping out on the surface of our skin, reminding us of the life force that flows within. I met a woman in Berkeley who liberates urban creeks. I visited some of the sites where she and her crews have unearthed culverts and smashed them with sledgehammers. After the stream is daylighted, they try to recreate what was once a natural creek. They need to reconstruct the creek's original course. She tells me they do all kinds of topographical and hydrological studies, but in the last analysis, it will be the pre-existing placement of fire hydrants and street lamps that determines the path of the reborn creek's meanders. After the creek's channel is open to the sky, the stream banks are planted with native vegetation, which will take years to establish itself. But just the hint of plant life growing along these new shores draws people of all ages, like the riverbanks that our grandparents played along when they were children. When the powers that be are not yet ready to set their culverted creeks free, this woman encourages watershed councils and local environmental groups to hang banners along the courses of these subterranean rivers to remind people of the waters that lie beneath their feet. I discovered such a banner following the course of the Blackstone River a couple years ago when I was visiting my parents while my father was ill. The banner runs along a rotary at the northern end of Main Street, the entrance to downtown. I tried to imagine what the city would be like if instead of this rotary, a river ran where I was driving, and you had to cross over the water on a little bridge to enter downtown. My father died just before spring. Our family assembled one last time in this central New England mill town where I had grown up and then fled. To my father, this town was the center of the world, and he never understood why any of us wanted so badly to leave. It was early March, and though the sun was trying to shine on the morning of his funeral, a chilly wind pierced the layers of my clothing. Despite the cold, I decided to take a long walk. The hotel where I was staying bordered on a row of 19th century brick factories. When I was a kid, these factories were still operating. The smoke that belched from the stacks covered the brick-fronted factory buildings with a veneer of soot. I spent much of my childhood reading stories about pioneers trekking to Oregon. I dreamed of living in a landscape of forests and rivers, but instead I lived less than a mile from this row of factories, and the only remotely natural feature of the neighborhood was Institute Park, which had an artificial pond that began across the street from the factories and stretched the length of the park. I yearned to live near a real body of water, but this pond was the closest thing. I often played along its banks where reed grass grew, but we were told to stay away from the far end of the pond. I never knew why, only that there was something potentially dangerous there. A few ducks lived by the pond, but nothing like the flocks of ducks and geese that crowded the small pond a mile away in Elm Park, where we went ice skating each winter. We knew that there was something odd about the pond in Institute Park, because in the winter it never really froze. And we knew that industrial waste fed the mucky pond through a series of outtake pipes hidden among the rocks and broken cement boulders lining the shores. The night before my father's funeral, I ate dinner with my family in a restaurant housed in one of the old factories across the street from the pond. Outside the bathroom, I noticed a series of historic photographs of the factory complex, taken in its heyday before the Great Depression, when the town boasted of being the world's largest inland industrial center that didn't sit on a river, as long as you weren't counting the Blackstone River. I studied one of the photos, an aerial view of the pond in Institute Park. At one end, you can see a dam, and across the street from the dam is the row of factories. Looking at the photo, I wondered if the pond had been created by damming the Blackstone River and then sending the river waters underground. When I got back to the table, I asked my uncle, who, like my father, believes that this town is the center of the world, and he likes to think that he knows everything there is to know about its history. How was the pond in Institute Park made? Did they dam the Blackstone River to make it?
No, not the Blackstone, some other stream. They built the dam to get power to run these factories, and that's what made the pond.
Why did they put the Blackstone River underground?
I watched them do it. It was in a canal before they covered the canal and buried it.
Was it ever a natural river, or was it just a man-made canal?
Oh, it was natural once, long ago, before I remembered. They lined the riverbed with cement long before I was born. But I watched them cover the canal with cement, like they made it into a giant sewer pipe, and they put the river underground.
Why did they do that?
I have no idea. That's what they did in those days.
Many of the old factories in my hometown are now factory outlet stores. The factories that neighbor our hotel are mostly restaurants, though the old print shop at the corner of Factory Row is still a functioning industrial artifact from the past. My uncle said, however, that it stays in business by selling discount office furniture. It was a Sunday morning and not even the restaurants were open. Scattered between the restaurants are a few upscale businesses, a hair salon, a computer consultant, some professional offices. With their brick walls sandblasted and rejuvenated, I find these buildings fascinating, even beautiful. I marvel at the details in the architecture, the brick and stonework, the intricately turned wrought iron railings, the enormous divided light windows. Such a far cry from today's industrial parks. I can see the soul now in these buildings. But I remember when I was a child, how I was repelled by the dirt and noise that enveloped this block. Working factories don't have the same charm as gentrified factory buildings. At the end of the row of factories, I crossed the street where there was a little bridge. Below the bridge, a small dam held back the invisible waters of an underground stream. A controlled amount of water was spilling over in a series of flumes that fed Salisbury Pond. This was the place my mother thought was too dangerous for me to play when I was little. I could see across the pond to the swings and slide and little gazebos where I did play, and the bandstand where we would listen to Sunday evening pops concerts in the summer. I climbed down the bank and stood on a flat rock beside the pond. I could see no trace of the old outtake pipes, and the pond water reflected the blue sky. Lots of birds fluttered in the tall grass that grew along the shore, and geese and ducks were swimming in the water. I wandered behind the row of factories across a vast terrain of cracked asphalt. The remains of railroad tracks crisscrossed the pavement, reminding me of a time long before I remember when goods and materials were carried by train instead of truck, and the trains came right up to factory gates like this one. From the rear of the factories, I could detect a few signs that the industrial past had not totally disappeared. Trucks waiting until the next morning to be unloaded, pallets stacked on loading docks, bales of wire, rusted chains, pieces of heavy equipment. Across the way from the loading dock, I spotted a set of wrought iron steps descending half a story down to a basement doorway. Above the door was a simple sign, black lettering on a white painted surface, "The Well." And above "The Well" was a Chinese hexagram. I stared at the doorway. Was it an artist's studio or a subterranean coffee house or the portal to another reality? I glanced around the factory yard again, at the quiet of stilled machinery and hibernating vehicles. I looked back at the hexagram, and I realized I was having an encounter with the I Ching. I might not know what lies behind the door that calls itself the well, but on the morning of my father's funeral, I had found my way back within. Below my feet flowed the Blackstone River. Probably no creek liberator will ever direct a sledgehammer's blow at the culvert that imprisons this river's soul. But I have found the way to the well, where water is drawn up through the roots of plants to nurture our souls. In the afternoon, my father was buried at a cemetery on the other side of town. As we walked from the graveside, it began to rain. This is the hexagram. There are six lines: broken, solid, solid, and broken. Wood is below, water above. The wood goes down into the earth to bring up water. In the well, there is a clear, cold spring from which one can drink. One draws water from the well without hindrance. It is dependable, supreme good fortune.
I'm beginning to see what used to be in the landscape familiar to me. The river speaks to those who hear with open hearts and ears. Stand upon a dam and dream the falls would reemerge, and we could see the pictographs and petroglyphs submerged. Memories linger where spirits used to soar. The fishing house is standing, but the salmon come no more. Underground through culverts of our soul, as the wind blows through my mind, ancient memories unfold. Surface of the river is tamed and chastened now. Barges filled with wheat and wood float slack water now. Acid waters hear the roaring of the falls. Salmon leaping rapids in the springtime and the fall. River speaks to those who hear with open hearts and ears. The river cannot take.
Hidden Waters was written, told, and produced by Barbara Bernstein. Bill Tate played Uncle Max. Music was composed and performed by Barbara Bernstein. Special thanks to Frank Palma, Dime Roberts, Melissa Marsland, Anne Selland, Marie Selland, Elaine Velasquez, Izetta Smith, Ellen Goldberg, and Jerry Mayer. This program was funded in part by the Regional Arts and Culture Council. This program is available on CD or cassette from Feather & Fin Productions, P.O. Box 82777, Portland, Oregon 97282. That's Feather & Fin Productions, P.O. Box 82777, Portland, Oregon 97282. CDs are $15, cassettes are $12.